Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Fueling the ethanol industry. Recent EPA move applauded. A recent move by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is being welcomed as good news for Iowa farmers and ethanol producers. The agency's decision to deny several waivers that allow oil companies to use less ethanol will result in an additional 1 billion bushels of corn being consumed, according to Bill Horan, a Calhoun County farmer who personally lobbied President Donald Trump on behalf of ethanol producers in 2018. "That's a big deal," he said of the projected increase in corn use. However, it may be a year before area farmers see the impact of the EPA's decision, he said. The ethanol industry has been hit hard by the drop in demand for fuel during the COVID-19 pandemic. "The biggest part of the problem is we're not driving very many miles," Horan said. He added that some ethanol plants may end up closing. The biodiesel industry, he said, is in better shape than the ethanol business because big trucks are still rolling throughout the country. Exports to China may prove to be another bright spot for Iowa farmers. China was already buying corn and soybeans, and Horan said a recent typhoon that devastated crops there may prompt the country to buy even more. The EPA's decision came less than 2 months before the presidential election. "It makes you wonder," Horan said. "They need Iowa. I would hope the decision was made because it was the right thing to do, but I'm sure it was a complicated decision." The move was welcomed by Iowa commodity groups, which have long pushed the EPA to put an end to the waivers. "By having the gap waivers denied and looking to deny future waivers, this helps secure the renewable fuel standard for the future and allow some certainty for Iowa's corn farmers in a year that has had little rewards," Carl Jardin, president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association, said in a written statement. Jeff Jorgensen, president of the Iowa Soybean Association, said, "Iowa's biodiesel plants and soybean farms, like mine in southwest Iowa, and our communities will benefit from putting an end to the slow leak that has hampered the renewable fuels standard." Fort Dodge Lions to host Mental Health Symposium. Event will take place September 24th. Mental health is an important issue with very few clear-cut answers, and the Fort Dodge Evening Lions Club is hoping to facilitate some discussion that will lead the way to answers and support. The club is hosting a mental health symposium at 6 p.m. on September 24th at the Cardiff Center at Fort Frenzy, 3232 First Avenue South. "We have a lot of mental health problems in Webster County, and we sure need to get something going to help," said Bill Oberhelman, a Lions Club member and organizer for the event. "We've got a lot of need for something like this, and any way we can help, we're certainly going to try to do that." The symposium will feature an array of speakers to cover all aspects of the mental health crisis, Oberhelman said, including State Representative Ann Meyer, a Republican from Fort Dodge, Webster County Sheriff Jim Stubbs, Fort Dodge Police Department representatives, Fort Dodge Fire Department representatives, local pastors, and others. Angela Tharp from the National Alliance of Mental Illness of Central Iowa will also speak during the event. Following the speakers, there will be a panel discussion to close out the symposium. "I hope that we do some good for mental health in Webster County and for the surrounding counties around Fort Dodge," Oberhelman said. "Hopefully we can get the Lions involved in that and get some help going their way." Social distancing and the use of face coverings will be encouraged at the event. An unofficial gathering. Doodlebug enthusiasts turn out despite cancellation of annual reunion. This week was supposed to be the 34th annual Doodlebug Club of America reunion, the celebration of the little red scooter produced in Webster City from 1946 through 1948. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, organizers decided the best thing to do would be to cancel the event for the safety of all involved. So on August 10th, the group announced that there would be no reunion in 2020. That didn't stop some diehard Doodlebug fans from traveling to Webster City this week. Wednesday afternoon, about 20 Doodlebug owners set up campers and tents at the Hamilton County Fairgrounds for an unofficial gathering. Scooter enthusiasts pulled into the fairgrounds from Nebraska, Minnesota, and even California. A few more riders are expected to arrive today and Friday. Remember, this is an unofficial, it's a non-event, said Webster City Club member Jerry Wells. But Matt Smith worked with Gerald Hoisman to make this happen. Smith of Fremont, Nebraska, said he was disappointed about the cancellation, but it didn't take long for an alternate plan to develop. He said he thought it was important for the group to get together this week. I think everybody's been cooped up too long, and I figured we could social distance and do it outside. Everybody seemed to jump on board when I mentioned it, Smith said. There's a lot of people who look forward to this every year. Hoisman of Webster City said a flyer was sent out announcing the Outlaw event. The flyer explained that if people wanted to come, there would be people here, Hoisman said. I've never seen attendance like this on a Wednesday, even when they have the regular reunions, he said. It's humbling. Unlike the traditional reunion, this week's gathering will be held outside and there will be no banquet. But like in previous years, there will be plenty of opportunities for riders to hit the trail. Hoisman said that riders were given permission to travel the streets of Webster City as long as they were in groups of at least four. They'll also take to the Boone River Recreational Trail for a ride to Briggs Woods Park. We're hoping to do two or three of those rides, Hoisman said. The city manager gave us the option to do the ride out to the airport. We just need to give him a call, and they'll even give us a police escort. Smith said he started attending the Doodlebug reunions as a boy with his father. This year, he's brought his daughter, Mayann, 13, and son, Mason, 11. His sister and brother-in-law also drove in for the gathering. Smith brought along five of his 12 scooters for the event. Dad missed the first reunion but came to the second one. I came to the third one and have been attending ever since, Smith said. The fellowship with other Doodlebug owners is what keeps bringing him back to Webster City every year. We've made some great friends, he said, and the riding helps too. Three generations of the Rosen family drove cross-country from California to attend the event. Kevin Rosen said he wouldn't have missed it and loves the community. We look forward to this every year, Rosen said. This year, he brought his daughter, Reagan, 15, and his dad, Brian. Rosen said he tells people all about the annual reunion in Webster City when he goes to shows around the country. I know if people come, they'll be back every year, he said. Rosen and Smith both said they appreciated how the community of Webster City rolls out the welcome mat each year for the scooter enthusiasts. The city here is awesome for letting us come out and ride on their streets and the trails, Smith said. I don't think there's any place like it in the world. Marshalltown starts work on Edgewood Extension with $2.9 million grant. A lot happened Wednesday morning. Marshalltown started the extension of Edgewood Street and received an economic grant all before noon on Wednesday. Joel Fruchon, director of the Office of External Affairs and Communications in the U.S. Department of Commerce's Economic Development Administration, visited Marshalltown to announce a $2.9 million grant during the groundbreaking of Edgewood Street Extension. I'm pleased to announce that the U.S. Department of Commerce's Economic Development Administration is investing $2.9 million in the city of Marshalltown to stoke industrial development by extending Edgewood Street, Fruchon said. We're honored to be here representing the Trump administration. The extension is long awaited because of the possible development it could bring into the area. The money will be matched with $1.4 million in state funds. Fruchon said the funds are expected to create more than 100 new jobs. The route will act as a truck diversion path for the intersection at 3rd Avenue and Marion Street. The intersection has become accident-prone because of 3rd Avenue's heavy traffic and led to some fatalities. Marshalltown Mayor Joel Greer was excited by the events. Greer has taken a number of complaints about the intersection during his time as mayor and city council member. This project will provide for heavy truck traffic to be diverted off Highway 14 and away from the commercial and residential areas, Greer said. EDA is committed to supporting locally driven strategies designed to help communities prepare for and recover from natural disasters, Fruchon said. Unfortunately, Marshalltown is no stranger to natural disasters. The grant is coming because of the 2018 tornado, but since then, Marshalltown has announced two more emergency declarations, the COVID-19 pandemic and August 10th derecho. The multi-million-dollar project has been in the works since 2018 and is expected to be completed by the end of 2021. Some of the funding for the road comes from a $1.6 million RISE, Revitalize Iowa's Sound Economy, grant through the Iowa Department of Transportation. After the groundbreaking, Frushone and community leaders went to Marshalltown City Hall for a roundtable discussion on economic development. Frushone said Iowa received $27 million in grants from the CARES Act to small businesses. The funding from the EDA is part of a $1.2 billion to help communities impacted by 2018 and 2019 disasters. The Edgewood Extension Project will create a safe roadway for truck traffic, provide additional flood protection, and open acres to developable lands for future business use, Frushone said. Iowa governor won't budge on masks even as virus deaths rise. Plenty of Republican governors initially rejected mask mandates, but few have held to their skepticism amid soaring coronavirus cases with the tenacity of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds scoffs at calls for a statewide mask order, calling them feel-good actions, and refuses to let city officials enforce local mandates, even as the small, largely rural state maintains one of the highest COVID-19 positivity rates and has topped 1,200 dead. While she implores residents to wear masks while indoors when social distancing isn't possible, she has said not everyone believes they're effective and frequently is photographed mingling at crowded events without a mask. "I think the goal is to do what we can to reduce the spread of the virus," Reynolds said last week. "I believe that is the end goal and that we can get there without a mask mandate. I believe that, and that's what I'm going to consistently do." It's a stand that has frustrated public health experts and exasperated some mayors. But unlike governors in other states, Reynolds has made clear she's not budging. Reynolds's argument against a mandate boils down to 3 points. A mask requirement can't be enforced, other factors are to blame for rising virus cases, and people should have the freedom to make their own choices. "I trust Iowans to do the right thing, and I think they are doing the right thing," she said. Faced with rising virus cases, other Republican governors took a decidedly different approach. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott had for months said the state couldn't order people to wear masks. But in July, after virus cases and hospitalizations soared, he ordered that face coverings be worn in public throughout most of the state. It was a similar story in Mississippi, where Governor Tate Reeves resisted a mandate before issuing an executive order requiring masks at public gatherings and in retail stores during August. He later extended the order through September 14th. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp also reversed course last month when he issued an executive order allowing local mask ordinances to be enforced on public property and on private property if the owner agrees. The governors of North Dakota and South Dakota also have rejected mask mandates, but their stands are now being tested as coronavirus cases increase in both states. In Iowa, calls to require masks have increased and now include the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The group late last month noted Iowa had the highest rate of new cases in the nation per 100,000 people and found more than a quarter of Iowa's 99 counties had high levels of transmission. Those rates have since dropped slightly. The task force called for a statewide mask mandate, closure of bars across the state, restricted restaurant attendance, and limits on crowds to no more than 10 people in the worst 28 counties. Reynolds closed bars in 6 counties, but ignored the mask recommendation along with most of the other guidance. Photos of Reynolds at events without a mask frequently circulate on social media, although Reynolds said it's often a case of her removing her mask only for a quick photo. Some pictures show her with no mask while mingling with people, hugging individuals and holding conversations well within 6 feet of others. "We'll take them off for not even a minute, snap a shot, and then we'll put them back on," Reynolds said. "I try to lead by example, but remember, if you can, social distance. But if you can't, you should have one ready and you should put it on." Reynolds defends using coronavirus funds for staff pay. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday There is nothing inappropriate about her decision to spend nearly $450,000 in federal coronavirus relief money on salaries for aides in her office, including her chief of staff and spokesman. Reynolds addressed the matter at a press conference for the first time since a report was posted Sunday by Laura Bellin, publisher of the liberal-leaning online blog Bleeding Heartland. The report, based on information Bellin obtained through a public records request to the Iowa Department of Management, indicated 21 employees on Reynolds' staff will have more than 60% of their salary paid with federal emergency funds from March 14th through June 30th. Reynolds said the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or CARES Act, allows salaries to be paid for workers whose job requirements are significantly changed due to the coronavirus pandemic. CARES funding can be used for salaries. That's very clear in what allowable allocations are, she said. She said when the first COVID-19 cases were identified in Iowa in early March, she moved half of her staff to a state emergency operations center to organize the state's response. They worked 9 to 10 hour days, 7 days a week on the virus, she said. The other half of her staff remained at the Iowa Capitol, working similar hours, answering questions, and working to meet the needs of Iowans, Reynolds said. The governor's office confirmed the expenditures with the U.S. Department of Treasury Office of the Inspector General, said Reynolds' chief of staff, Sarah Craig. Craig said the money hasn't shown up in CARES Act expenditure documents yet because the governor hasn't signed the transfer of money, but after she does, the spending will show up in public documents. It wasn't immediately clear what happens to the state money that had already been allocated to governor's staffer salaries. The amount sought from the federal funds for 21 governor's staff members will total $448,449, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett confirmed. Senator Joe Bolcom, the senior Democrat on the Senate Appropriations Committee, said Iowans should have confidence the federal COVID relief funds are being spent to help residents. Instead of using funds that are desperately needed to provide relief to hardworking Iowans and closed or struggling businesses hurt by the pandemic, the governor is diverting the relief funding for other purposes. That's not right, he said. Editorial. Support Go Big, Go Dodgers event. Fort Dodge Community Schools Foundation fundraiser helps kids. Our public schools are among the most important institutions in our community. Quite simply, the educational work they undertake shapes the children who will be the future of our city, state, and nation. Funding the school system is an expensive undertaking. Unfortunately, the monies available from local, state, and national governmental sources are often insufficient to pay for all those things that are needed to achieve the educational goals we have for our kids. That's why the fundraising undertaken by the Fort Dodge Community Schools Foundation provides an important enhancement to public education in our town. It plays an important role in helping to fund educational materials within the school system, according to Nick Mosier, the foundation's director. In the past, the foundation has paid for programmable robots, math and literacy materials, metal shop tools, and musical instruments. The foundation's annual Go Big, Go Dodgers fundraiser will begin at 6 p.m. Saturday at Fort Frenzy, 3232 First Avenue South. Tickets cost $40 per person and are available at fdcsfoundation.org. They can also be purchased at the door. This is a huge event for us, mainly because we're putting 100% of the money we raise back into the district and investing in our kids and teachers, Mosier told The Messenger. It's really a celebration of our schools and our community. The annual event has raised more than $380,000 for the schools since 2011. The Messenger enthusiastically supports the foundation's important work. We urge our readers to help it achieve its goals by attending Saturday's event and assisting the foundation throughout the year. Participating in Go Big, Go Dodgers will help make our excellent school system even better. Besides, Go Big, Go Dodgers promises to be a really fun night. Unfinished business. Number 3 Cowgirls ready to take the next step. Success on the volleyball court has brought the entire Clarion Goldfield Dowse community together as the team has put together a successful program that has everyone in the district showing their cowgirl pride. Clarion Goldfield Dows has reached the state tournament 2 years in a row, and its fans have been by the squad's side every step of the way. "The support we have received is amazing," said eighth-year head coach Katrina Turhock. "Our crowd comes up with all kinds of different chants and cheers. The community has been rallying behind us. I have gotten random emails and text messages and cards, especially right now, from people who have been looking forward to watching this team play." The third-ranked Class 3A Cowgirls ended a nearly 20-year hiatus at state by qualifying in 2018. They made it back-to-back years after reaching the Class 2A semifinals last season. The significant steps the program has taken under Turhark has brought the entire group together. "Last season, we reached out to family members without the girls knowing to leave messages for the entire team," Turhark said. "We watched that before our state match, and the impact that the families' messages had on the girls was tremendous. There were so many people that wanted to reach out and be a part of something special. We are a true volleyball family. We talk about it all of the time. The coaches are in their corner, and we are here for them. It just comes down to having great kids. They're fun to be around and fun to coach." The year's senior class has put together a memorable run for a group that has been playing together since third grade. The Cowgirls have put together a combined record of 93-27 in the last three campaigns, and CGD was the North Central Conference champion in 2019. "They have a love and passion for volleyball," Turhark said. "They all have great personalities, and when we are playing our best volleyball, they are having fun. You can see their personalities come out on the court, and they are super competitive. They understand their roles and get along well, and they have spent a lot of time on the court together through the years. The camaraderie and family atmosphere has been pivotal both on and off the court. A large senior class led by Morgan Middleton, Jaden Jondal, Kendall Linneman, Emma Conlon, Elena Frizzleben, and Nicole Waters have been the anchors. This group has been fun to watch and coach," Turhark said. "They built relationships on the long suburban rides and bus trips. They are really selfless and take responsibility if they have an error or a play that doesn't go right. They never blame others. It's fun to see the cohesiveness. That is hard to instill." The Cowgirls started the season 9-0 before dropping two matches. CGD lost to second-ranked Dyke New Hartford in Class 2A and number 2 Osage Class 3A recently. Middleton, who will play volleyball at North Dakota State University next season, leads Class 3A and is sixth in the state in kills with 159. Middleton is fourth in 3A in kill efficiency at 40%. Jondal is second in 3A with 28 service aces. Frizzleben leads the team with 228 assists, and Jondal leads in digs with 86, while Linneman has 50. "This group is unique," Turhark said. "We have a lot of traditions that they have built and have done it together, coming back this year with no seniors from 2019. It's been a couple of years like that, so it's kind of a different feel with so many 12th graders this time around. Every day they come in with a different intensity about them. They always want to get better and have fun." Triton men capture title. The Iowa Central men's and women's golf teams hosted the fall kickoff at the Country Club on Tuesday. The men shot a 296 to win the crown. DMAC, with a score of 304, was second. Iowa Central placed all four counters in the top eight. Justin Shipper was the meet medalist with a 2 under par 69. Teammate Austin Erickson was second with 74. Simon Mitchell at 76 was seventh, followed by Kylie Willey with 77. "Our performance was a great one for us," said Iowa Central head coach Chris Graywin. "We've been preparing like crazy to finally get out and play, and we were able to put together a really good round as a team. Anytime you win an event, it's special, but it's our team's first win of the year, and it's my first team win as a coach." Iowa Central's Kelly Bolin won the individual crown by shooting an 82. Bolin shot a career-low 37 on the front nine. "I could not be more proud of Kelly," Graywin said. "She has put in so much work over the summer and this fall, and I was so happy for her. She is a fantastic young woman and a great student. The excitement and emotion out of her after her round when she found out she won is the reason I am in coaching. Trump says he can talk GOP into going for larger virus aid. President Donald Trump parachuted into the coronavirus aid debate Wednesday, upbraiding his Republican allies for proposing too small of a relief package and encouraging both parties in Congress to go for a bigger one that would include his priority of a $1,200 stimulus check for most Americans. But his top GOP allies in the House and Senate shrugged off the president's mid-morning tweet for more aid. They also weighed in against a $1.5 trillion aid package backed by moderates in both parties that earned praise from the White House. Trump, by evening, dug in. "I like the larger amount," Trump said during a press conference at the White House. "Some of the Republicans disagree, but I think I can convince them to go along with that." The president said he wants Americans to be given relief checks and thinks he's getting closer to a deal. Negotiations remain far apart. All the key players in the entrenched impasse over a COVID-19 rescue package instead focused their energies on finger-pointing and gamesmanship, even as political nervousness was on the rise among Democrats, frustrated by a stalemate in which their party shares the blame. There remained no sign that talks between the White House and congressional Democrats would restart. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, says any deal will have to include far more than just another set of Trump checks and a handful of other priorities. "All they want is to have the president's name on a check going out. That's all he really cares about," Pelosi said. "We have to do more than just have the Republicans check a box." At issue is a potential fifth coronavirus relief package that would extend supplemental jobless benefits to replace a $600 per week COVID unemployment benefit that expired at the end of July. It would also funnel more than $100 billion to help schools open, provide assistance to state and local governments, and funnel more money into a program that directly subsidizes businesses hit hardest by the pandemic. The bipartisan spirit that birthed the $2 trillion aid package in March has evaporated. Many Republicans cite deficits and debt and are simply wary of another Pelosi-brokered deal. As the talks progressed, Senate Republicans made their proposals smaller, moving further away from Democrats. One dead, five suffer minor injuries in Iowa school bus crash. One person died and five juveniles suffered minor injuries when a van collided with a school bus Wednesday in northeast Iowa, the Iowa State Patrol said. The patrol said a driver veered onto the shoulder of a county road in Benton County and overcorrected before colliding with the bus. The van driver died. The five students on the Benton County School District bus suffered minor injuries. The bus driver was not hurt. No names have been released. The investigation is continuing. Trump disputes health officials, sees mass vaccination soon. Openly contradicting the government's top health experts, President Donald Trump predicted Wednesday that a safe and effective vaccine against the coronavirus could be ready as early as next month and in mass distribution soon after, undermining the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and calling him confused in projecting a longer time frame. Trump also disagreed with Dr. Robert Redfield about the effectiveness of protective masks, which the president recommends but almost never wears, and said he'd telephoned Redfield to tell him so. Earlier in the day, the CDC sent all 50 states a playbook for distribution of a vaccine to all Americans free of cost when one is proven safe and effective, which is not yet the case. Redfield told a congressional hearing that healthcare workers, first responders, and others at high risk would get the vaccine first, perhaps in January or even late this year, but it was unlikely to be available more broadly, again assuming approval before late spring or summer. Redfield, masked at times in the Senate hearing room, also spoke emphatically of the importance of everyone wearing protective masks to stop the pandemic, which has killed nearly 200,000 Americans. He floated the possibility that a vaccine might be 70% effective in inducing immunity and said, "I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine." You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Thursday, September 17th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Georgia Lee Gum. Georgia Lee Gum, 69, of Fort Dodge, passed away Tuesday, September 15th, at her home in Fort Dodge. A celebration of life will be 10 a.m. Tuesday, September 22nd, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Visitation will be from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday, September 21st, at the Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Fort Dodge. Georgia is survived by her two children, Laura Smith and spouse Joe of Fort Dodge, and Corey Gum and spouse Jessica of Council Bluffs. Five grandchildren, Caden, Carson, Madison, Chelsea, and Reagan. Her mother, Joyce Gadbury of Nearham, and her mother-in-law, Betty Gum of Spirit Lake. Brothers, Alan Gadbury and spouse Janet, and Lyle Gadbury and spouse Kathy. Sisters, Donna Pinkowski and spouse Jerry, Jana Graham and spouse Jim, Carol Heinlein and Karen Reed and spouse Mike. Brothers-in-law, Steve Gum and spouse Mary, and Tom Gum and spouse Jody. And a sister-in-law, Deb Orness and spouse Tim. She is preceded in death by her husband, Daniel Lee Gum, her daughter, Breanne Lee Gum, her father, Donald Jack Gadbury, father-in-law, D.R. Gum, and youngest sister, Sharon Stewart. Georgia Lee Gadbury, the daughter of Donald Jack and Joyce Axelson Gadbury, was born June 29, 1951, in Fort Dodge. She graduated from Manson High School in 1969. She attended college and received her teaching degree. On July 8, 1978, Georgia Lee Gadbury was united in marriage to Daniel Lee Gum in Nearham. She worked for 29 years as a special needs teacher for Iowa Central Industries and for the Fort Dodge Community Schools. Georgia had a big heart and a passion for serving special needs kids. She enjoyed lake time at Okoboji and watching Hallmark movies. Georgia also enjoyed spending time with her five grandchildren. She always said, "Love you more." Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Marlene O. Fievold. Marlene O. Fievold, 87, passed away Friday, September 11th at Pearl Valley Rehab and Nursing of Gowrie. Private family funeral services will be at Zion Lutheran Church in Gowrie, with Pastor Jim Davis officiating. Private family burial will be at Gowrie Township Cemetery. A public visitation will be after 4 p.m. Monday, September 21st, at the Palmer Funeral Home in Gowrie. Marlene is survived by her sons, David Fievold of Harcourt, Philip Fievold of Farmingville, and Daniel Fievold and spouse Steve Williamson of Billings, Montana. Daughter Kathy Hansen of Gowrie, grandchildren Dustin Fievold and spouse Christina, Derek Fievold, Preston Fievold, Bryce Fievold, Gage Fievold, Olivia Hansen, and Jenna Hansen. Great-grandchildren Colton Fievold, McKenna Fievold, and Kaylin Fievold. Her sister, Pauline Johnson and spouse Richard of Gowrie, and other relatives and friends. She was preceded in death by her parents, Elmer and Mabel Carlson Johnson. Marlene O. Johnson was born November 13, 1932, at Gowrie and graduated from Gowrie High School. In 1956, she was united in marriage to Dean Fievold, and the couple established their home on a farm near Gowrie. The couple later divorced. For many years, Marlene provided in-home daycare. She was a member of Zion Lutheran Church and Bible study. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Isaiah Ike Hill. Isaiah Ike Hill, 81, of Fort Dodge, died September 11th at TRMC. Services will be 1 p.m. Saturday, September 18th, at Loffersweiler Funeral Home. Burial will be at Pilgrim Rest Cemetery in Wilson, Louisiana. A visitation will be 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Mr. Isaiah Hill was born in Wilson, Louisiana, on August 7, 1939. He was the 16th child of a family of 18, born to his parents, William and Iva Williams Hill. He moved to Fort Dodge in the early 1960s. He joined the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, which later became Union Pacific, from 1973 to 2004. He retired after 31 years of service. Isaiah loved to bowl, fish, hunt, and garden. He is survived by his beloved wife of 30 years, Maddie S. Mosley Hill, sons Rio Mosley and spouse Yolanda, Christopher Mosley, Charles Mosley, Chad Grady, daughters Phyllis Payton and spouse Stephen, Renetta Pate and spouse Rick, Alice Mosley Rose, and Wanda Mosley, a brother and two sisters. Albert Odin. Service is 1:30 p.m. Saturday at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church in Carnarvon. Visitation is 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Farber and Ottoman Funeral Home in Wall Lake. Donald Lannis. Services are 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at Grace Church in Algona. Visitation will be 4 to 6 p.m. Friday at the Lentz Funeral Home in Algona. Beau D. Levain. Beau D. Levain, 44, of Manson, formerly of Fort Dodge, passed away on Sunday, September 6th. Services are pending with Loffersweiler Seaver's Funeral Home. We have some time left, and so we'll read some stories from the Webster City Daily Freeman Journal. E.T. to be shown at Avila Plaza. The final summer outdoor movie of 2020 will be held Friday night at Avila Bank Plaza. E.T. the Extraterrestrial will be the title of the movie to be shown, according to the Webster Theater Facebook page. The movie was scheduled for last weekend, but was rained out. The movie will begin at 8 p.m., and those attending are asked to bring blankets or lawn chairs to sit on. The movie is sponsored by First State Bank and Town and Country Insurance. The Webster Theater will be open for popcorn and soda purchases, and the restrooms will be open. Mobile Food Pantry coming to Jewell. The Food Bank of Iowa Mobile Food Pantry will be coming to Jewell on Thursday, September 24th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Those who need extra food for their family are invited to stop. The distribution will be conducted at Bethesda Lutheran Church, 439 Main Street. Those attending are asked to pull up to the main door and stay in the car. Volunteers will bring the food to the car. Free school meals offered at St. Thomas in Stratford. St. Thomas Aquinas School has announced that starting this week, the school is participating in the extension of the Summer Food Service Program until December 31st or until the funds are depleted. Meals will be provided to the school's enrolled students in grades preschool through sixth grade without charge and are the same for all children regardless of race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability. And there will be no discrimination in the course of the meal service, officials said. For more information, contact the school at 832-1346. Stratford Community School District has also announced that the school will serve free meals to pre-kindergarten through sixth grade children attending school in the district due to an extension in funding from the USDA. The program is approved to operate through December 31st or until funding runs out. One breakfast and one lunch per day per student is included. A la carte items, adult meals, and extra milk are not included in the program. For more information, contact the Stratford School Office at 515-838-2208. McFarland Clinic to offer flu shot clinics. Flu shots are now available at McFarland Clinic in Webster City. Designated flu clinics at the Family Flu Clinics are available to schedule online. Patients can also request a flu shot vaccine at their next appointment or call to make an appointment. Information about the flu shot or to set an appointment online, visit McFarlandClinic.com. And that's McFarland Clinic. The clinic recommends everyone 6 months of age and older be vaccinated against influenza every year. The flu vaccine prevents infection with influenza, a contagious virus with many of the same symptoms as COVID-19. Officials said the flu shot will help maintain health and safety and will reduce the surge of illness in our communities and preserve healthcare resources. Free student meals. WC schools to offer free lunches for all in-school and remote students. Students in the Webster City Community School District will now receive free breakfast and lunch meals following notification last week from the USDA that the district was approved for the program. The Food and Nutrition Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced in late August that the free summer meal programs could continue into the fall and possibly as late as December 31st, depending on how long the funds last. Webster City Food Service Director Lori Hartnett said that students in the district in grades K through 12, including those who are learning remotely, can receive meals at no cost beginning immediately. Hartnett said families with remote learners can pick up meals daily from 11 to 11:15 a.m. only as follows. Northeast Hamilton for NEH students. Middle school for middle schoolers or Sunset Heights students. High school for high school students and Pleasant View students. Each building has a sign with the pickup door location, she said. At Northeast, it's at the south daycare entrance. The middle school pickup is on the north side, and there's a doorbell there. At the high school, they can pick up at the loading dock area near the tennis courts. There's also a doorbell there, Hartnett said. Those picking up meals just have to ring the bell, and a staff member will bring the meals to the door. The meals are the same as those being served to in-person students in the district. Hartnett said there was no need to call ahead to reserve a meal. The student doesn't need to be present to pick up the meal, but the district will need to have the name of the child, Hartnett said. The program is just for students enrolled in the Webster City Community Schools District, she added. Students will still have to pay for a la carte items, and the program does not cover adult meals. Hartnett said she believed that the free meal program will have a big impact on local families. We know there's a need. Our district is over 50% for the free and reduced meals as it is, she said. To me, this is a huge thing. I hope we get more kids to eat lunch and breakfast. Rotary Club to continue turkey dinner. Drive-through event to be held at Conference Center. The Webster City Rotary Club's annual turkey dinner returns on Sunday, October 11th. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, there will be some changes to keep the fundraiser safe for all. The dinner site has been changed to Briggs Woods Conference Center. There is no dine-in or carry-out as in past years. The takeout dinner will be served from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. as patrons drive up to the door. Central Catering will again be preparing the turkey, gravy, and dressing. The staff at the Conference Center will be preparing the mashed potatoes and green beans. A dinner roll and snack bar complete the menu. All tickets are $15 and must be purchased from a Rotarian in advance. There will be no tickets available that day. Proceeds from the turkey dinner have made it possible for the Rotary Club to support several local causes for over 40 years. The public support is encouraged so the organization can continue to contribute to Meals on Wheels, UDMO, All Cultures Equal, Wilson Brewer Park, Hamilton County Crime Stoppers, Backpack Program, Hamilton County 4-H Foundation, Building Families, and all food pantries in the county. An editorial from Kathleen Parker. To Mother Earth, the real pandemic is us. Is doomsday here? Joe Biden asked Monday during a blistering speech about the West Coast fires and several tropical storms brewing offshore. Sadly, given the season, the wildfires devastating parts of California, Oregon, and Washington have only added to the political tinder as the election nears. Meanwhile, tropical storms and hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean and Gulf of Mexico soon will flood the airways with tragic images alongside political ads and the latest COVID-19 statistics of the sick and the dead. Biden's speech, delivered in his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware, and obviously written for targeted effect, harnessed fears of the nation's most coveted constituency, the swing voters of America's suburbs. He may as well have been galloping astride all four horses of the apocalypse, with flames and floods chasing the thundering hooves. Wildfires are burning the suburbs in the West, he said. Floods are wiping out suburban neighborhoods in the Midwest. Hurricanes are imperiling suburban life along our coast. If we have four more years of Trump's climate denial, how many suburbs will be burned in wildfires? How many suburban neighborhoods will have been flooded out? How many suburbs will have been blown away in superstorms? I won't be surprised if Biden wears green tights and a cape for his next speech. Costuming aside, Biden at least was addressing what President Donald Trump basically refuses to. So, which is most to blame for the fire and smokes blanketing the western United States? climate change, as the left insists, or poor forest management, as Trump and others insist. How about both things at once? Asks a rare voice amid the cacophony. Tom Mullican, who has appeared in this space before, is an environmentalist and lawyer who has been working in the climate change trenches for decades. He happens to live down the street from me and is a reliable source on all things climate. Once a protege of Al Gore, the original Cassandra of climate change, Mullican has made his own documentary, The Whole Truth, in response to Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. I called Mullican to get his thoughts about Earth's current convulsions and what our response should be. First, he said, the wildfires are the result of a confluence of rising temperatures and poor forest management. But many West Coasters don't want to talk about the need for logging, culling, and controlled burning of forests, while others don't want to hear about climate change. Another problem, he said, is our inability to merge the macro, climate change is a global problem, with the micro. Oh, darn, my house is on fire. The first seems too much to handle. The second is local in the extreme. But a truly global policy without exceptions is essential if local eruptions are to be prevented. As for Biden's list of planet-altering proposals, Mullican is skeptical, and he's right to be. There is little evidence throughout his political career that Biden ever really prioritized the environment and combating climate change. Even as vice president, he reportedly wasn't involved in the Obama administration's signature accomplishment of helping make the Paris Climate Agreement a reality. In other words, Biden's concern about climate change is, well, somewhat new. Then again, the Trump administration has, for the last 4 years, worked against seemingly any and every environmental initiative, even one supported by his own party. The undeniable truth is that whatever we're doing isn't working. Mullican pins the world's failure to heal the planet in part on the 2005 Kyoto Protocol, a global treaty the United States ultimately did not join, which called for developed nations to reduce greenhouse emissions. But the agreement exempted developing nations from regulatory requirements, including China, India, and Brazil. Today, China, though still considered developing, produces more hydrocarbon emissions per year than the total gross emissions of the United States, according to Mullican. Mullican, a pro-business Republican who recently retired as commander of South Carolina's National Guard and who is now wrapping up a PhD in theology, says there needs to be a global approach to include all nations without exception. No environmental problem is strictly local, as when NASA satellites showing a toxic cloud from China headed for the California coast confirms. A dream team to hammer out such an accord would consist of natural scientists, hydrogeologists, geologists, and oceanographers, among others, to the exclusion of politicians. With 7.8 billion people crowding the planet, clear-cutting forests for agriculture and development, infiltrating previously protected ecosystems, and destroying Earth's natural protective barriers, it would be naive to expect that things will get better on their own. Earth, after all, is a living organism fighting for her life, and we humans are her pandemic. Hurricane Sally unleashes flooding, hundreds rescued. Hurricane Sally lumbered ashore near the Florida-Alabama line Wednesday with 105 mile-per-hour winds and rain measured in feet, not inches, swamping homes and forcing the rescue of hundreds of people as it pushed inland for what could be a slow and disastrous drenching across the deep south. Moving at just 3 miles per hour, or about as fast as a person can walk, the storm made landfall at 4:45 a.m. close to Gulf Shores, Alabama, about 30 miles from Pensacola, Florida. It accelerated to a light jog as it battered the Pensacola and Mobile, Alabama metropolitan areas encompassing nearly 1 million people. Sally cast boats onto land or sank them at the dock, flattened palm trees, peeled away roofs, blew down signs, and knocked out power to more than 540,000 homes and businesses. A replica of Christopher Columbus's ship, the Nina, that had been docked at the Pensacola waterfront, was missing, police said. Sally tore loose a barge-mounted construction crane, which then smashed into the new 3-mile bridge over Pensacola Bay, causing a section of the year-old span to collapse, authorities said. The storm also ripped away a large section of a fishing pier at Alabama's Gulf State Park on the very day a ribbon cutting had been scheduled following a $2.4 million renovation. By the afternoon, authorities in Escambia County, which includes Pensacola, said at least 377 people had been rescued from flooded areas. More than 40 people trapped by high water were brought to safety within a single hour, including a family of four found in a tree, Sheriff David Morgan said. Authorities in Pensacola said 200 National Guard members would arrive Thursday to help. Curfews were announced in Escambia County and in some coastal Alabama towns. Sally turned some Pensacola streets into white-capped rivers early Wednesday. Sodden debris and flooded cars were left behind as the water receded. By early afternoon, Sally had weakened into a tropical storm. Its maximum sustained winds fell by Wednesday night to 45 miles per hour, and the National Weather Service said heavy rains were spreading to the north and east into eastern Alabama and western Georgia. Big Ten is a go for October. Conference reverses field will play despite ongoing COVID concerns. Players were pumped. Coaches were stoked. Fans seemed relieved. Even the president was pleased. The Big Ten is going to give fall football a shot after all. Less than 5 weeks after pushing fall sports to spring in the name of player safety during the pandemic, the conference ran a reverse Wednesday and said it plans to open its football season the weekend of October 23rd and 24th. Let's go, Ohio State quarterback Justin Fields tweeted. Amid the celebration, a word of caution. This is still not going to be easy. We can't emphasize enough that what we're putting forward still requires prevention, requires accountability from everyone involved, from our student athletes to coaches to staff, to be doing the things to prevent getting this infection, said Dr. Jim Borchers, the team physician for Ohio State. And our progress will be measured by their efforts, but also we hope by the efforts to provide a clean competition and practice environment. All 14 teams will be scheduled to play 8 regular season games in 8 weeks, plus have the opportunity to play a 9th game on December 19th when the conference championship game is played. The college football playoff selections are scheduled for December 20th, which means the Big Ten's best should be back in the hunt for a national championship, if all goes well. If it does not, the schedule does not provide much room to adapt. Other conferences built in bye weeks, which allows time to deal with potential disruptions. The Big Ten itself did that back in early August, but now must go forward with a condensed schedule and signs that things could go awry. Across major college football since August 26th, 13 games have been postponed because of teams dealing with COVID-19 outbreaks. Some have not been rescheduled. The Big Ten is banking on daily testing to mitigate the risk of outbreaks and decrease the probability that a few positive tests will gut rosters when contact tracing sends players into 14-day quarantines. The Big Ten will begin daily antigen testing of all fall sports athletes, coaches, and staff September 30th. The Big Ten is taking an especially cautious approach with those who do test positive. The earliest an athlete will be able to return to game competition is 21 days after a positive diagnosis and following a cardiac evaluation and clearance cardiologist. We're in a better place, regardless of how we got here or how painful it was during the time we waited to get this moment, Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith said. That's all behind us. What's beautiful is that we have a process and protocols in place that's based on science and based on lessons learned since August 11th. The Big Ten said its Council of Presidents and Chancellors voted unanimously to restart sports. The vote last month was 11-3 to postpone, with Ohio State, Iowa, and Nebraska voting against. Still, the Big House in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Beaver Stadium in State College, Pennsylvania, won't be packed with 100,000 fans, as is usually the case in the fall. Not even close. Tickets will not be sold to the general public for Big Ten games, though some attendance is expected. That's still an 80,000-seat stadium that we don't have, said Wisconsin Athletic Director Barry Alvarez, who had estimated the loss of football would cost the school $100 million. The decision to play came after sharp pressure from coaches, players, parents, and even President Donald Trump, all of them pushing for a Big Ten football season. The conference is home to a number of battleground states in the November election, and Trump swiftly applauded the move. The seriousness of the pandemic is still very real, but I'm pleased for our student athletes, coaches, and fans that we've been able to create a path forward, University of Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta said. The medical professionals at every Big Ten institution have worked tirelessly to create strong protocols that can be consistently applied to every campus. The frequency, availability, and reliability of daily testing was a game changer. This announcement has been much anticipated as it relates to football, but the path forward approved by our presidents and chancellors was important for all sports. I'm thankful for the time President Harold and every Big Ten campus leader dedicated to this resolution. This is welcome news for all of our players, coaches, and fans, Hawkeye head coach Kirk Ferentz said. Our focus is now to train and prepare to compete on October 23rd and 24th, recognizing the health and safety of our players as our number one priority. I am proud of the attitude and work ethic of our players that has been displayed over the past several weeks of uncertainty. The players are very excited to play, and the coaches are excited to coach them. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with some stories from the Webster City Freeman Journal for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.